This podcast is brought to you by the Ed Warner Fund for Mental Health Awareness. Menace to Society. All right, welcome back. Episode 4. I just want to really talk about where we're at, kind of reflect on this podcast and this show and how it's going. And I really want to, here's why I know we're on to something really great. Not only the support I've received and we've received through email and social media, but also from friends of mine, and specifically friends that are in the coaching industry, you know, that are big time programs, Ohio State, Penn State, Florida, across the country, really. And I got a text from one of those coaches, and I want to read it right now, and I'm going to leave them anonymous as a friend of mine, and I don't want to put their name out there unnecessarily. But I got this text on Saturday from him after I spoke with him on the phone. He said, here's the text. He said, remember this statement. I'm sure as soon as you read this, you remember me always saying this. Leverage your influence. Zach, you, me, all of us have an opportunity to influence one singular person or maybe numerous people every single day. You can negatively impact them or positively impact them. It may be a simple smile or frown. It may be a word of encouragement or a discouraging word. Fact of the matter is, that you get to decide how you do it. I just wanted to tell you to use your gifts and influence on others and impact others positively, my guy. Keep going. Thanks for taking my call. Just been thinking about you. Messages like that, phone calls I've received, let me know that this is an avenue to influence people, to provide entertainment, provide insight, do all of those things. And this is going to be bigger than I thought it could be, and I'm excited for it. I also wanted to send a message to people that like to verbally harass me about the adversity I've gone through. Not because they deserve a response, but mainly because I feel like people that are doing that are confused on what happiness is. My career didn't define me. Being a coach at Ohio State was not my worth. Making $400,000 a year did not provide me happiness. No different than losing my job, my career, my professional life. It didn't change who I am. It didn't change my drive, my passion, my will to be successful and provide a great life for my family. I'm happier now than I have ever been. Money didn't make me happy. And not having that money doesn't make me miserable. I am happy because I choose to have a positive mindset, even with all the stuff I've done and the stuff I've gone through. I'm happy because I have genuine relationships with my family and closest friends and my kids. That's what made me happy when I was coaching, and it's what makes me happy today. So I feel sorry for people that believe money or coaching at OSU is a happiness provider, because by assaulting me about losing those two things, it shows me you believe that identity was who I was. It is not. And I hope you find true happiness in your own lives outside of money or status. So I really want to invite people that might want to be a part of this show, this movement. I'll invite you to support us. We want to increase the frequency like we discussed. We'll be doing it twice a week this week and hopefully going to increase it in the future. We also want to increase the capabilities of this show and reach out if you want to be a part of it. We've had some sponsorship and advertising offers already, but want it to be the right fit. We don't want to sell out just for anything or anybody. So if you're interested in a partnership or supporting what we are doing, go to our website, www.menacetosocietypodcast.com, and drop us a note or email directly at zach@menacetosocietypodcast.com. So a few questions I have read in response to my story in the first three episodes that I want to address, because like I've said from the start, you know, nothing is off limits. The first is the DUI that I got charged with in 2012 that no one knew about. People have asked that. Did Urban know about it? No, no one knew about it. I got pulled over. It was in the off season. The officer had asked if I had been drinking. I told him no. They asked to do a field sobriety test. I did that. Then I didn't blow in a breathalyzer. And long story short, I got charged with DUI. It's something that I regret horribly. I was young. I was 27 years old, and that was an idiotic move. Something I'm deeply ashamed of, seeing as how dangerous and awful a selfish decision like that can end up being. It's also very common, which is not a good thing, but it's very common in society. And not only in society, but in coaching. I mean, shoot, I remember I was at Bowling Green and Dan Mullen got a DUI in 2001.
Really?
Yeah. And he, wow. and they had to bail him out the whole deal. Now, social media wasn't what it is now, but yeah. I mean, it's not uncommon, and that's sad to say, but I don't want it. I'm not going to not address it. That happened. I did it. I owned it. I went through the legal process, and when it got reduced and it wasn't a DUI anymore, I didn't feel the need to tell anyone about it. I also knew how the media would portray it. So I just moved on and learned from it and never would do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very common just in all walks of life, but it's crazy that Dan Mullen got one, and that's not, I've never heard that.
Yeah, I mean, there's several more. Yeah. That's just one that just popped in my head as I was talking, but it's not a good thing. Like it's not an okay thing, but let's not crucify me like no one else in the world has ever done it. Well, yeah. And again, I own it, and it was a big mistake. The other thing people have asked a lot about is, because I brought it up, I think my attorneys brought it up, is just kind of in how family court works. And for those that don't know, it needs to be brought to light. And for those that do know, you feel my pain. There's a lot of question about these contempt of courts and parenting, because see, what happened is after I got fired, everything changed in my life personally with my family, my kids. And I filed to increase custody time and to change the support agreement, because my ex-wife is getting, I think, $6,000 a month. So whatever that, it's almost $75,000 a year. And the minute I got fired, the next month, when she obviously didn't get that check, she filed a motion on me demanding that I pay that child support.
Oh, with zero income.
With zero income at her fault.
Yeah.
Or, you know, at her motivation. But anyways, that also... that led me to I filed these motions, and that was in beginning of August last year. And my court date is scheduled for the end of August this year. So 13 months it's going to take to get in front of a judge and see these contempts of court and things like that through, which is crazy. But that's the way family court works, especially in Delaware County, Ohio. It's something else.
That's insane. And just the fact that you have had so many different court dates and they keep getting pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. And it's not like it's a random court. It has to deal with the custody of your children, and you can't get in front of a judge.
Well, you can't when someone's fighting that court date. But anyways, I just wanted to provide that update and just kind of provide some clarity on that, because I've talked about it and people had questions. I just wanted to clear it up before we get into the meat of the show. Another thing that a lot of people asked about that I want to get into was just the story I told about how working for Urban Meyer and the greatest discomfort was when things were going well. And I wanted to tell a story. I had lunch with a former colleague at Ohio State. He's a great player, All-American, and then worked on our staff. And we had a conversation, and I forgot this story. It's a great story. It was the first time I experienced that, right? Okay. That discomfort when things are going great. It was our first spring at Ohio State. So this is spring of 2012. We go and we have a scrimmage. It's, I think, our second scrimmage of the spring. And it was like, finally, things started clicking a little bit. It was a great day. Like, we had a great practice, offense, defense, both starting units performed well. And one of Urban's greatest mentors is Lou Holtz. Right? Yeah, and he was in town watching practice. So we walk off the field. It's our best practice yet. Urban is, I mean, just elated with how it went, especially because his mentor was there watching. And so he kind of felt proud that his mentor was watching this great practice. And so everyone came off the field feeling amazing, right? Yeah. So we come in, coaches go work out, you know, guys are, you know, feeling good about how things are going. And then Urban goes to lunch. So he goes to lunch with Lou Holtz and comes back and calls an immediate staff meeting. I mean, coaches are coming in like sweaty from working out, towels around their neck. I mean, guys are rolling in like, what is a staff meeting? Like, it's like an emergency. So we come in and he proceeds to destroy the staff collectively, each individual coach. It was the most brutal staff meeting I've ever been a part of. And everyone walked out of there wide-eyed, shell-shocked, like, what just happened?
Yeah.
So come to find out, our GA went down and talked to his assistant, one of his personal assistants, said, what happened at lunch? And he said, they were sitting there having a great lunch, and Lou Holtz looked at him and said, you know what, of all the places I've been, you know who drives their staff harder than anyone? Nick Saban.
Oh, of course.
Boy, You talk about the explosion that happened after that, because, you know, Urban has this that rivalry with Saban.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
To the point where, I don't know if people know this either, but we redid our locker room completely probably 3 years ago. And when we did it, you know, obviously Urban was involved in the design process, and he made them put in a waterfall. And he used to tell recruits this. He said, you know why we put the waterfall in?
No.
Because he heard from recruits that Nick Saban had a fountain. So we had to one up it and put in a waterfall.
No way. Oh, really? Yeah. It ran that deep.
Oh, it was. And part of it was, I think, fun and show. But there's a legit, I don't want to call it envy, but competition and rivalry there. And it was, and you saw it all the time. And it goes back to what I talked about, the chase. Like when he watched Alabama before they played Notre Dame in 2012, it was like he was chasing Nick Saban.
Yeah.
And constantly competing with Nick Saban in recruiting battles. My gosh, I recruited some kids like Pat Surtain, who's at Alabama right now. Mm-hmm. That was a head-to-head battle that I lost and we lost. Losing Kerry Combs certainly didn't help.
Yeah.
But those battles, like Johnny Dixon was another one. There was an Alabama-Ohio State battle that we won, thank God. but those battles were always a little bit more intense.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I want to get into kind of that time at Florida.
Yeah, what is, because that's where the rivalry really started. I mean, he got taken to another level when he was at Ohio State, I think. But what was the difference between Urban at Florida and Urban at Ohio State?
Yeah, well, obviously the rivalry was more relevant there because you're in the same conference. We met him in the conference championship twice. We played them, now before Saban was there, we played them another time. The biggest difference I saw in Urban from Florida to Ohio State is he obviously learned his lesson at Florida. And a lot of people have asked me, not only in relation to this show, but also just in general, was the health scare real? Was all that stuff real?
Yeah.
It couldn't have been more real. I mean, his wife called 911 because he was unconscious because of the whatever he had going on medically. Mm-hmm. And I think he was really scared that he was going to die from stress, basically, and that's why he stepped away. And I don't think it was a cop out or anything. Now, I will tell you this: he did a much better job at Ohio State delegating and stepping away from things that he knew his staff could handle, maybe even better than he could handle. So he did a better job of that. He was much more family oriented. Mm-hmm. He was he wanted to go be, you know, he would go to his son Nate's baseball games on Sundays, which at Florida he could never do that. He was too paranoid and obsessed with being there, controlling things and you know, making it happen at Florida. He also specifically recruited at Ohio State a different kid, a more high character kid. I don't know if you saw the news yesterday. Someone sent it to me, one of my good friends in coaching, that Tony Joyner, who was an All-American captain at Florida, just got charged with murder.
What?
Second player at Florida that got charged with murder. And I could tell some stories about that at some point. I probably will get into it. But those kids at Florida were a different character than Ohio State. But it goes back to recruiting. And I recruited South Florida.
Yeah.
The type of kid that is going to leave South Florida and bypass all those SEC and ACC schools and come to Columbus, Ohio, is a different quality of kid than is going to cut Ohio State. Because for a kid to come to Columbus, Ohio, the winters are cold. And I mean, they hear it all in recruiting. It's going to be cold, snowing. Big Ten is slow, all this other nonsense. And the kid that's going to pick Ohio State over Florida State is a kid that's going to see the benefit that Ohio State will provide him, right?
Yeah.
Our program, when it came to development, to academics, to the real life programs we put in place to develop them for afterlife.
Yeah.
I mean, those things were why you would get a better quality character kid in the program. So I've never in my entire career, never have I seen a team with as high a character as the end of my time at Ohio State.
Yep.
Those kids, I mean, my position group alone, receivers, normally you are not going to have, they had three captains in the receiver room this past year.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't think that's ever happened or will happen in college football. So those quality of kids were so much better. And here's what really caused, in my opinion, the meltdown at Florida. Mm-hmm. The program was like cooking with grease. It was on fire. The same staff was together from, you know, 05 to whatever, 07, 08, when things started to kind of derail. And you saw some of these great coaches that he had on his staff start to disperse and leave.
Yeah.
Right? Dan Mullen left. Greg Madison went to the NFL. Some of these coaches start leaving and he brings in, you know, newer coaches.
Yeah.
And those coaches maybe operated a little differently. Not that they were better or worse, but all of a sudden, the grip on the program started to slip.
Uh-huh.
And you saw the kids started running the program as opposed to the coaches running the program. And I think it got to the point where it was overwhelming and he couldn't take it anymore because he didn't have the support of the 10 coaches or whatever to help him run the program.
Yeah. So one thing that I wonder, I've heard a lot about this, and I don't know if he was this way at Ohio State, but I've read a lot about it at Florida, that the star players, the Percy Harvins, right, or whatever, really did whatever they wanted.
Yeah, I mean, not entirely. There was definitely a meritocracy is what he calls it. So a meritocracy, meaning if you are one of the hardest workers, you give it your all, you definitely have more leniency than a guy who maybe doesn't work that hard or doesn't, you know, isn't as invested. So I wouldn't say they got away with anything, but it also, crazy you bring up Percy Harvin. And I got a great story about Percy that I'm going to probably drop in the next episode or coming soon. But the one thing I will tell you about Percy Harvin is, to me, he was the best football player I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Ever. And it, here was the testament to that. So Urban, Percy got away with a lot.
Yeah.
He had a lot of things going on also, but he got away with a lot. I mean, shoot, he just flat didn't show up one Friday to go to South Carolina, just didn't come to the game. And he got away with a lot, but I'll never forget this. And this was a testament to how great, like Urban used to say, like, what do you do? Like, okay, you're not going to play him?
Right.
We won 2 national championships and he was 75% of the reason why.
Yeah.
And so Urban, I think he always struggled with the management of Percy. And what was really funny is we're at Ohio State and this is the year that Percy Harvin was the MVP of the Super Bowl.
Oh, okay.
He was with the Seahawks.
Yeah.
And we're sitting there in the staff room. I can't remember. This is, I think, a Monday game planning. And all of a sudden, Urban's phone rings. And he goes, oh, shit, Pete Carroll. And he walks out. Pete Carroll called him. And everyone's like, Pete Carroll, that's a random phone call in season, right?
Just sitting there. Oh, shit, Pete Carroll.
So he walks back in. Mind you, Pete Carroll coached Reggie Bush, like some of the greats of greats. And I guess the conversation was he was calling Urban for advice. Like, how do you deal with this guy? Like, how do you handle him, manage him? Yeah. And Urban was laughing like, good luck, bruh. He even said, good luck, bruh. But
I don't know. I couldn't do it in college.
Right.
But good luck doing it in the pros.
Right. And Pete Carroll even said it. He said, I've never dealt with this ever. He goes, Urban told our staff this. He said, but I'm going to tell you something right now, Urban. I think this son of a bitch might be the greatest player to ever buckle a helmet.
That's ridiculous.
That's how good he was. And apparently he had the same issues in the NFL as in college. But it was Percy was a great one, a great one. And he had a lot of issues. But the Florida team, the dynamic, the character across the board was just very different. But there was also some very elite character and players like Tim Tebow, for instance. My gosh, you can't be a better person than he is.
Yeah, but that's what I think, and maybe we get into it in another episode, but I think a lot of people want to know, is Tim Tebow actually Tim Tebow? Meaning, is he the person that he puts out there every day?
Tim and I were close when I was there, and I have a lot of great stories about Tim, but the short answer, absolutely. He is as advertised or better.
Really?
And there's no behind closed doors, one-on-one. He is that person. He lives it. It's not some front. It's not, he doesn't just talk about it. He is that person. So.
All right. So since we're talking about those days that you started out in Florida, I think the listeners would love to hear, you know, if you want to be a coach, how do you go about doing that?
Yeah. So I'm flirting with the idea of writing a book called So You Want to Be a Coach, because it's one of the toughest industries to crack into. It really is. And how you get into it is really, I don't know how people do it nowadays, especially because these staffs are now almost unlimited. Like back when I was at Florida, there was literally 2 GAs and maybe an intern or two. But when I was at Ohio State, every coach had an intern. You also had 2 GAs. They also had a quality control. I mean, the staffs are huge and all these kids or people are trying to get into coaching. And certainly my connections got me in the door. I mean, that's no question about it. Now, I took an intern job at Florida. I was the DFO's intern. So I like helped clean up after banquets and events and cookouts and things like that. But, and you know, it took me five years to become a GA and actually get a shot at coaching. But my grandfather, no doubt, got me the job. And Urban even said it. I'll never forget it. My grandfather, him and I went down there in the winter, or it might have been spring, right after Urban got hired.
Yeah.
And he basically asked him, hey, can you help my grandson, Zach, get into this? And I'll never forget, he called his secretary in and he said, hey, I need you to set him up to become like an intern, unpaid, you know, don't worry about anything. Just set him up so he can help out. And he looked right at me, and he was talking to his secretary. He said, I owe it to him. And he pointed to my grandfather and he looked at me. He said, I don't know this guy shit. I'm not giving him a damn thing, but I owe it to Earl. So set him up to be an intern, and that's that.
Yeah.
So he did that. And without that connection, it would provide even, or it would prove to be even harder.
Yeah.
But those connections also won't get you much further than that. They'll get your foot in the door, but I promise you, Urban Meyer is way too competitive to hire someone because they were somebody's grandson, brother, you know, husband. It just would never happen.
Yeah, no, he would do that, give you an unpaid internship.
Right. And that's so about it. To get into it is extremely competitive and hard. Now, the life once you're in it is insane.
Yeah.
I mean, you're working in season easily 140 hours a week. And I mean, we used to sleep in the office. They had a kind of a locker room for support staff with couches, and we'd sleep there 3-4 days a week. And also back then, I don't know what they make now, but when I was at Florida in 2009, I made $450 every 2 weeks. That was my pay. $225 a week, roughly. And now they pay for grad school, but now at Ohio State, you had to go to school. Like, the GAs had to go to class.
Yeah.
At Florida, I'll never forget, Dan Mullen looked at me and was like, okay, you can go to class, but you're not going to be a coach. Like, you're a GA. You're a coach. You're here to coach. Like, go do class on your own time. I remember I'd laugh and look at him like, when is my own time? When is that? Could you carve out what hour that is?
I'm sorry. They don't offer 2 a.m. classes.
No, and you have to do wild stuff. I mean, I'll never forget, I had to, and so this is one of somebody that I was really close with, is Steve Adazio. I've already talked about him, I think, twice. But I remember I had to go over and help set up his surround sound in his house. Like, you do random things. We had a GA. How about this? So Dan Mullen had a kind of an illegitimate child back when he was at Bowling Green.
Yeah.
And he used to once a month send one of our GAs on an airplane up to South Bend, Indiana to pick up his kid and fly him back.
Really?
Like, things like that go on. Like, you're doing some things like go wash a car. And that was back at Florida. Urban really cracked down on that at Ohio State. Like, there was none of that, because he thought your job was to develop him, that person, as a coach, not to have some personal assistant running to buy you, you know, a Diet Coke.
Not to have some guy to go pick up your kid.
No, yeah, that, certainly not that. But he definitely changed his perspective, because I think he got a little older and he started realizing that he was in the business of developing the future coaches of the sport.
Yeah.
And he put that onus on us as position coaches to do the same. So it was really, but it was wild. And it still is. I mean, it's still really hard. The only thing that's changed a little bit is the number of people have increased. So I think the workload is a little more spread out, but they also, it's the thing about coaching is they'll always find projects and work.
Yeah.
The more people you have, the more projects coaches will come up with. Like, you'll do studies about, you know, USC back in 2002 and what they did on offense, like things like that. And you're like, wow, is this really necessary?
Do we really need to know?
And one of the most futile examples was every year we'd game plan the first three opponents in June, right? In June, you'd go in depth, study them for 2 days and, you know, put together a game plan, a scouting report, everything. And you'd spend hours on it. And then sure enough, you'd come after 2 days, you'd go to game plan that team and you'd never even look at what you did in June. It was like, what was the point of that? How much time was wasted? Because we just scrapped it all and restarted and redid it again.
Yeah.
But when coaches have time, they fill it. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, you got to do something.
Yeah.
So we've talked a lot about what was different with Urban and Ohio State and how it was different than Florida. But from your time at Florida all the way up until your time at Ohio State, what was consistent with him the whole time?
Yeah. So the program was, there was a lot of core beliefs and values of the program that never changed. And I think the biggest thing as far as development and developing the team was just the competition element. I mean, it was competitive. Everything that went on was competitive, right? We had mat drills in the winter every Wednesday morning at 5:55 a.m., and everything was competitive, one-on-one. You know, Mickey Marotti is the strength coach, and he was the strength coach at Florida, and he's phenomenal at his job. And he would, you know, create matchups and create a buzz throughout the week of these matchups of Paris Campbell against Terry McLaurin on Wednesday's mat drill. And they'd go through every station competing with each other. And that's what really bred the development and you know, sped it up, was these kids weren't just going through a cone drill or weren't just doing a bone dummy combative drill. They were doing it against someone else. And that, you know, if you have any self-pride, when they post the records on Thursday morning of what you just did, if you went 0-14, wow, that's embarrassing.
Yeah, absolutely. It just breeds that competitive spirit into the player.
And it was everything. I mean, we, you know, every Monday, Thursday, we'd have speed and agility drills, and they would be all, you know, one-on-one, team versus team. There was, every offseason was different a little bit, but we'd create these, you know, eight-player teams, and they would take the guys they identified as potential leaders and empower them with a team of eight other players to try to motivate them and try to develop that leadership model. And then they'd go through and, you know, one team would lose, the other team would win. And the winning team would get ice cold Gatorade. The losing team would have to drink hose water and have to do some extra suicides after practice, or, you know, gassers or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
And there was also a point system, like an accountability point system. Where you would get points for, you know, for great workouts, and you'd lose points if you're ever late to a workout. And then they also, another thing Mick did was he would have these tiers. Like it was gold, scarlet, and blue. And you can imagine what blue was.
You did not want to be blue.
No, and it was really hard to become a gold guy. And that was a big thing towards the end of our time at Ohio State, was in my group specifically, we had a mantra. It was all gold, everything.
Yeah.
Gold academics, gold in the weight room, just gold socially. And and you'd go out to these team runs and there'd be 10 to 12 players with a gold shirt on with whatever logo. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the majority of the team would be in red with a logo. Yeah. And then there'd be those couple kids that missed a workout or were late. They'd be wearing a blue one.
Wow.
And well, we didn't have any blue shirts, but they gave them like a blue penny to put over their shirt. I don't think they wanted to fund anything blue.
They weren't buying blue shirts.
They found a couple blue pennies like in a back room somewhere.
Took them from the lacrosse team or whatever.
But Urban had this big thing about developing leadership in the offseason. He always talked about this model that he learned or had. It was a 10-80-10 is what he called it. And it applied to anything, business or football, a team, any organization or group of people. He said there's always, in any group of people that you put together, there's 10% of them are elite people, right?
Uh-huh.
They just operate differently. They have self-respect. They have an incredible work ethic. And they're just, they operate how you want. That's the culture you want. And then 80% of that group are average, right? They're just average people. Yeah. Like Urban would say it all the time. He's like, I'm an 80%er. I need to constantly fight to be in that 10% of elite.
Yeah.
And then there's 10% of the group that are, you know, the bottom feeders. They're what he called defiant and disinterested. And he would constantly preach about how do you convert the 80 to the top 10. And what he always talked about was kind of what Mick did in the offseason. The whole program was run this way, is he would talk about, in order to convert the 80% to the 10%, you can't do it as a coach. You have to give ownership to the upper echelon, the upper 10%. You give them ownership in their position group or in that 80%, because they will be the ones to pull guys out of the 80 up into the upper 10. And the 80%, it was all about showing them what elite was, encouraging them to mimic those actions. Mick used to say it all the time. Like, guys would come out with low energy or maybe like not like excited to be at practice. He'd send them back in the locker room and he'd always say, like, if you don't got it, fake it. Like, fake a smile. Come out. Like, just act like you're excited.
Fake it till you make it.
Right. And the biggest problem that I think coaches, leaders, business CEOs, executives have, that, and Urban said it all the time, was you spend far too much time on the bottom 10%.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, those people are defiant, disinterested, maybe bad character, maybe just not ever going to make it, not ever going to cut it. And the more time you spend on them, the less time you spend on the 80% that want to be great. They want to be coached hard. They want to be in the upper 10%. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. And so would he kind of advise you to not spend your time on that, like to kind of ignore the bottom 10%?
He kind of spoke out of both sides of his mouth. He'd say that, like, any time on the bottom 10% is wasted time. Focus on the 80. But at the same time, he always said, never give up on a player.
Exactly.
You know, and there'd be times where you knew your players better than him. So you could go and you could really try to, you know, motivate or save one of the bottom 10%. And he might think you're an idiot. And then all of a sudden, boom, it happens. They flourish. And he used to say it all the time. He said, never give up on a kid. But he'd also at the same time say, any time wasted on the bottom 10% is a waste of time. And yeah. you're hurting the upper 10% and the average 80. And it was all about creating a culture at Ohio State. He was always trying to perpetuate this culture.
Yeah.
And that way the culture could drive the leadership, could drive what you wanted, the results, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was it worked, obviously. I mean, yeah. he turned programs around immediately. Like,
oh, quick.
I mean, in one offseason program, I mean, Ohio State had the worst season in 110 years. The next year, 12-0.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. And that was a process. And that's probably something we need to get into at one point. It was a 2012 season because it really, those kids, those leaders, they set the table for what was to come the next 7 years.
Yeah.
And it was really...
Well, and bringing it back to his time at Florida, I think his second year he won a national title at Florida, right?
Correct.
That was always his thing. Was his second year was always like the way, like the time that it took off for his program. Like Utah, second year undefeated. Bowling Green, second year went 7-5, first winning record in a long time, and yeah, right. then Florida, second year national title. But the amazing thing I think when you look at his time at Ohio State is how he fast tracked that to day one.
Yeah, and I think it's just kind of how it worked out.
Yeah,
it was also a testament to Jim Tressel and Luke Fickell and the players they had here, the type of kid they had here. And there was definitely a rough transition from the Jim Tressel mode of coaching and the Urban Meyer mode of coaching, which, and Urban, you say it all the time, is like, neither one is right or wrong. It's just different.
They both show results, so it could be either one.
And it was definitely an adjustment, and it took some time to get them to buy into the way we were trying to do things. But obviously, it ultimately worked out, and it looks good on paper. We were 12-0, but there was not buy-in until after Michigan State. I think week 5 of 2012.
Yeah,
like that season was about to be a bad one.
Yeah,
and something clicked, and we'll go into that. Those details later, but it was definitely it was not an instant transformation. Yeah. It was really hard and it took a lot of time, but it happened. All right, now a little transition, something that we didn't get to last week on the episode. We ran out of time, but we want to make sure we get into, because it's one of the reasons why I really want to do this show, is our Twitter tough guy of the week. As we said before, the problem with social media is people in glass houses a lot of times throw stones, and a lot of times they hide behind anonymous profiles, and it's really cowardice, and it's kind of funny, but it's the world we live in now. It's the Twitter world we live in. So this week's Twitter tough guy is a gentleman by the name of Donald J. Burns.
Oh,
DJ Burns.
DJ for Ohio.
Yeah, DJ Jazzy Jeff. So DJ used to be a reporter for 11 Warriors, and we will get into 11 Warriors at a later date. DJ was a reporter, and I use that term loosely. I don't know what that even means anymore, but he was a reporter that, I don't know how much you get paid to do that, wrote an article every now and then decided he was going to become a politician. So long story short, he started everything that was coming out about me. And this is like pretty recently, like after it died down, like I guess he was fighting for relevancy. I don't know. He just wanted to comment about me all the time. And I actually had someone reach out to me and send me an article about him. Like, this guy really needs to shut up because he lives in a big, big, big glass house, like really glassy.
Yeah.
And so DJ Burns, when he was at the University of Montana, got charged with conspiracy to commit robbery, 2 counts of accountability for aggravated kidnapping, because during a break-in, they pistol-whipped one house occupant and confined a woman with duct tape.
Oh my God.
The motive for the robbery was theft of drugs and money. Burns then fled to Ohio after the robbery. According to the plan, he was to go to the house prior to this robbery and buy weed, then report back to the group and plan the robbery, with his buddy, Ronald Powell Jr., a.k.a. Dirty.
Dirty.
When you're hanging out with a guy named Dirty, probably doing some bad shit.
Dirty, what a name.
So then he decided to own his mistakes, which I'm all about change. I'm all about owning mistakes and moving on. He ran for to be in the Ohio House of Representatives, I believe it was. And certainly if there's a dirty world for a committed or someone that committed robbery and duct taped a woman, it's to be a politician. Unbelievably, I know it's I can't Who could have imagined he lost?
It was close, wasn't it?
Yeah, Jen Appel got 76% of all votes, he didn't do well. It was kind of a landslide. No. But the moral of the story is, Donnie, don't judge other people when you have skeletons. Everyone has them. You don't need to come at me or anyone else. You're not perfect. I'm not perfect. No one's perfect. Time to move on. Just worry about yourself, getting better, and be positive. Spread positivity, DJ. So that's our Twitter tough guy of the week, DJ Burns.
Wow, that's crazy. People really will say whatever they want behind a keyboard.
I'll say anything.
So that transitions perfectly into our social media Q&A for this week. We went through a lot of the questions that you guys sent in, and trust me, even if we don't get to it this week, we have them saved. We might get to it next week, so keep listening. You might be called out. First question comes from a guy named Joshua Kassinger. Mm-hmm. What was your first impression of Ryan Day when he stepped foot on campus? And my favorite play was the Michael Thomas catch versus Alabama. How many times did Evan Spencer and Michael work on that play during the season?
Oh, man. So that's a two-part question. So that play is a great one of the greatest plays that I was ever a part of. And obviously, it's my proudest play because I had three guys on the field. All three touched the ball, resulted in a touchdown, a game-changing momentum moment in that game that led to a national championship. So a funny backstory about that. I have two stories for it. The first one is we worked on that play all year. We put it in as a trick play. We worked on it, every Thursday. And Evan was really, really proficient throwing the ball. Like, he could throw the ball. He thought he was like Warren Moon, I think is who he said, or whatever. He thought he was like a quarterback that was disguised as a receiver. But so we worked on it all the time. And the first time we called it, if you look it up, against Michigan State, we ran that play that season in 2014.
Really?
We called the play. Michael Thomas goes in to fake crack the safety and then runs like a corner route, right? Evan gets the ball. Mike's open by about 5 yards. But the coaching point all along was, if it's not there, tuck it and run.
Yeah.
Well, Mike was open by 5 yards, and Evan was like, I don't know, nervous, didn't whatever. And so he tucked it and ran. So it looked like kind of a reverse that didn't work out. I think we got 6 yards. And I mean, Michael Thomas roasted him so bad on Sunday. Like, bro, you claim to be this quarterback. Like, how much more open do I need to get for you? Like, throw me the ball. Da, 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 da. Like, and I mean, all the players, we put it up in the team meeting. Tom Herman put it up and made fun of him. The whole team was laughing at him. And so fast forward. We go to play Alabama.
Yep.
And so I was actually the one that brought it up. I said, what about the reverse pass? And Urban was like, oh, shit. So we call timeout. He's like, do we really want to do this? Like, we're going down to end of half. Like, this is a
key moment.
Pivotal moment. And so Urban makes a call. He says, yep, let's call it. So I grabbed Evan. I said, Evan, we just need points. We just need a field goal. We're in the red zone. If he's not there, throw it into the stands. We also couldn't afford, there was not enough time on the clock.
Yeah, we couldn't run it.
Yeah, so the coaching point all along was not relevant anymore. So I said, if he's not there, throw it in the stands, right?
Yep.
So if you watch the play, the kid Cyrus Jones was the corner for Alabama, and he covered it perfectly. I mean, it didn't deceive him at all. He was in man coverage, so he had no reason. He was well-trained by Nick Saban, a DB coach, to have eye control and focus on his guy. So Mike was not open. But the good thing about Michael Thomas is when he's covered, he's still open.
He can still catch
it. And so Evan still threw it. And it was one of those where everyone was like, no, yes. Yeah. And but that was a crazy play. And it was just funny how it all worked out.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget it. When they came off the field, I was like, I looked at Evan. I was like, you son of a bitch. You could have got me fired if you'd have thrown a pick right there.
Right.
But then getting back to the first part of that, Ryan Day. So I've known Ryan Day since 2005. He was a GA at Florida when I was there. I was like an intern that helped him put in data, and I helped him with some game day stuff. So I've known him for a long time. Didn't really know him as well until he got to Ohio State. But here's what Ryan Day is. He's very, very intelligent. He also took 2 years in the NFL and didn't have to recruit, didn't have to do anything. So he just studied the game, studied offensive football, and he's by far the best pure quarterback coach I'd have ever seen.
Yeah.
The fundamentals, the stuff he taught, I mean, it was next level. Like, I used to sit there, he would talk about Tom Brady and the throwing mechanics coach that Tom Brady has, who was a golf coach, has no idea about football, but I mean, I could go into details about it.
Yeah.
Probably talk over some people's heads, but he was elite at that. Mm-hmm. And as far as this football scheme, excellent. I mean, one of the best I've ever been around. And players really, he related well to players. Now, what he's very high IQ, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he had a great way of developing a bond with players.
Okay.
And the players really loved him. They thought he was a great coach. Obviously, now he's the head coach. And when it comes to recruiting, he's a great recruiter because he's very organized and works really hard. And he's a great communicator. He was excellent with families. Like him and I recruited Chris Olave together. We recruited Garrett Wilson together. And he was unbelievable. The amount of contact he had with the mom, the dad, the kid's brother. I mean, he overwhelmed them. It was something Urban preached a lot and he was great at it. Doc Holliday was similar to this, where he would have all these tentacles and wrap every facet of a kid's life around those people. And he would get them all six people, seven people, whoever was on the inside circle for that kid, he got them. And when he did, it was magical. I helped recruit Olave. I helped recruit Garrett Wilson, but Ryan really got him.
Yeah.
I played a part, and he was elite with the families ultimately. Yeah.
So that's really interesting, because that parlays perfectly into the next question. So this is from Dennis Smith, and he wants to know, he said he's really interested in the dynamics around parents once a kid is in the program. Yeah. He'd appreciate any perspective you have around how much interaction you had with parents on a regular basis, how you deal with high maintenance parents, and how proactive elite programs are at keeping the parents in the loop and keeping them informed about things. And also just any crazy stories you might have about parents.
Oh, man. Yeah. So, I mean, I never had anyone that was just like batshit crazy. I have a couple that were, but they just loved their kid. I mean, they were good parents that loved their kid and wanted their kid to be successful. I had one kid that played for me that was a highly recruited kid. I'm not going to bring up his name, but he was probably the fourth best player at his position. And every week I had to talk to his dad. Every week he would call Urban, like, why isn't my kid doing this? I know he can do this as good as this guy. And so it's constant maintenance. But also there's some, like Devin Smith's dad is a great example. He loved his kid. He knew what his kid was, what his potential was. We had a lot of conversations, and ultimately Devin played as well as he did because his dad, Urban, me, we all got on the same page and helped Devin elevate his game. Yep. Michael Thomas, I talked about already. Keyshawn Johnson, his dad, Urban, and I all got on the same page. And that's the biggest problem, is coaches and parents sometimes are not on the same page and don't know. And but when you're a position coach at the level of Ohio State football or somewhere like that, you're intimately involved with these parents' lives. It starts in recruiting and it continues on further. I mean, I still talk to former players' parents to this day. Yeah. That's out of nothing other than a genuine relationship now. Obviously, I have no bearing on their kids' lives. But it was definitely... It was one of the hardest parts of the job, was dealing with the high maintenance parents, but it was also rewarding. You got to see the reward of a Devin Smith or Michael Thomas, where, you know what, it might have been difficult to work out at the beginning, but when it clicks and works, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, for sure. So the one thing that I saw a lot on social media, and Mark Stensler asked it, and it's perfect, is can you spend some time discussing your relationship with Urban since everything happened? And do you guys have one, or have you not spoken to him?
Yeah, no, I haven't spoken to him. I, for whatever reason, I don't really care. I don't need to speak to him. I'm not. It's not a relationship that I have to have. It was a close relationship, which is unfortunate. It's definitely my fault as much as anyone's. I only saw him once, and it was kind of a bizarre occurrence. I was at a restaurant with a bunch of family and friends, and he came in with his daughter, and his daughter saw me, told him, and he like hightailed it out of there.
Really?
So I think it's probably something that he just doesn't want to be in that situation just because of the perception, or maybe he doesn't like me. I don't know. It's irrelevant to me, but no, there's been no relationship, no communication, no interaction, nothing. I mean, I've seen his daughter one time or twice, and that was very cordial, very nice. She's a great woman, and the whole family's great. I just there's definitely no interaction though.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, I think that's enough questions for now. I think that's about time we wrap this up. I just do want to preview kind of where we're heading with this. I definitely want to get into some of the stuff at Florida. I've talked about it today a little bit, and definitely want to talk about some of the players. I talked about Percy Harvin a little bit. I want to talk about him more. I definitely want to talk about guys like Joe Hayden, Aaron Hernandez still I haven't gotten to, and then the Pouncey Twins and all the great players that we had at Florida. And definitely I want to kind of give you some insight into the plans for the future. We intend to, as we get closer to football season, do some positional breakdowns on not only Ohio State, but some national programs, conference analysis, national analysis, give you kind of my perspective, where I'm coming from and what I think coming from a former football coach. And then once we get into season, I definitely want to every week provide scouting reports, matchup previews, games of the week, kind of because what I know about programs and the players there and the coaches there, and then some predictions, some game recaps. I'm gonna watch the film and give you my analysis of some games and what I saw that happened coming from a former coach. And then again, I said at the beginning, I want to invite people that might want to be a part of this. I think this could be something really big, and would invite you to support us, retweet us on social media. Definitely go to the website, which we mentioned before. And I want to increase the frequency and capabilities of this podcast, this show. Like I said it earlier, we've had some offers. Definitely interested in hearing more to find the right fit, the right partnership. If you're interested in advertising or promotions or really anything, feel free to reach out. You go to contact us on our website, www.menacetosocietypodcast.com, or you can drop me an email directly at zach@menacetosocietypodcast.com, and that's the number 2. So again, thank you for tuning in. I hope you were entertained. Hope you were informed. Hope you got something out of it. If you liked it, great. Share it. Tell people about it. If not, go fuck yourself, San Diego.
Menace to society.